Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. David James. He's author of Discovering Your Magnificent Mind. People have struggled for thousands of years to find happiness and fulfillment, but now it's clear that you can have the life that you desire if you learn to use your mind correctly. Today, in the realm of miracles and mystery, being understood in a new way as the connection between mind, body, and spirit becomes clearer and more accessible to you. Your mind is not only a powerful ally in your quest for a better life, but it's also your link to others and to the divine through the energy web of all creation. In this easy-to-read and practical book, Dr. David James, an expert on personal transformation, introduces you to your magnificent mind and shows you how to harness its power to create a life filled with happiness, abundance, and well-being. Dr. David James is a master of transformation, a compassionate healer, and compelling public speaker. With a diverse educational career and a service background, David has the ability to touch the hearts of everyone that he encounters. He holds a doctorate degree in clinical psychology and graduate degrees in spirituality and human development. David is a certified hypnotherapist and is in private practice in Beverly Hills. He teaches meditation in the San Fernando Valley. David speaks to audiences, both large and small, in the U.S., Canada, sharing his insights into the magnificent mind. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.davidjameshypnosis.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, I'd like to welcome David to the show. Good day, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here.
It is my pleasure, and I am all ready to tap into that magnificent mind of mine. So,
good, and it's ready to be tapped into, so wonderful.
All right, well, I'm glad to hear that. So, well, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you have a very diverse background, and I'm just curious, would you mind sharing with the listeners just a little bit about your journey and how it kind of flowed, because it seems to have had many different forks and twists and turns.
I will. You know, T.S. Eliot, famous author, he said that God always writes straight with crooked lines. And that's certainly part of the story of my life. God writing straight with crooked lines. I am exactly where I was supposed to be, but you would never know it had you joined me at the beginning of my professional journey in 1976, when I was sworn in as a deputy sheriff for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Nor would you probably have figured that I would have been at this place in 1982 when I was a narcotics detective, or on the SWAT team, or in 1988 when I retired from the police department and went to seminary, or in 1992 when I was ordained an Episcopal priest. Nor would you think that I would be in this place necessarily when I was a pastor of Episcopal churches in both California and Washington State. But as we get closer to today, it begins to unfold in a way that makes sense. As I had my PhD in clinical psychology, I was doing so much counseling work that I probably thought I should learn something about what I was doing. And then about 5 years ago, I returned to Southern California, having retired from the church, and was certified in hypnotherapy. It was just a fascinating field of study for me. And now I have the privilege, blessing, and honor to work here in Beverly Hills in a medical group that helps people who are getting free of addictions and helping them reduce anxiety and pain, and working with folks from outside also who want to change their lives. So it's been a lot of crooked lines leading straight to this point here with us today.
Yeah, well, you know, the one thing I've noticed is that, you know, even though, you know, the crooked lines, I mean, it always seems that, you know, life builds upon, you know, all of our experiences build upon each other and kind of leading us, you know, to ultimately do, you know, what our heart really wants us to do. And it seems like that's exactly where you're at. So, I want to talk a little bit about hypnosis and kind of the work that you're doing right now, and then we'll move on into talking about, in particular, the book Discovering Your Magnificent Mind. So, regarding hypnosis, there are a lot of people, first of all, are there... Can hypnosis help everyone? I mean, is everyone able to be, who's, you know, their problems treated through hypnosis, or does it have its limits?
Well, you know, I have a saying, and that is that whatever the mind creates, it can recreate as well. So if the mind has created a problem, whether it's in our physical bodies, in our emotional mind, or in our spiritual self, the mind can recreate that using hypnotherapy. There used to be in the therapeutic community a feeling that there was a percentage of people who could not be hypnotized.
Mm-hmm.
Now we come to understand that unless there's some very specific brain abnormality or traumatic brain injury, apart from that, the only people that cannot enter into the hypnotic state of deep relaxation and focused attention are those who don't want to. So it's a much more wide open field and to be able to help people.
Yeah. So, and in order to use this methodology, does the person have to, I guess, believe in the power of hypnosis?
Actually, you know, what they have to do, I mean, that helps, certainly, because if you're already disposed by belief to thinking that something's going to be good for you, it will be.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the power of the placebo effect that's in my book, and we'll talk about that a bit. But I do have people who have watched stage shows where people are hypnotized and bark like dogs or quack like ducks or take their clothes off. And so there are five myths that you have to dispel. And once you dispel the myth that stage hypnosis suggests, then most people are able to relax enough to let us get into the place of the hypnotic state where we can help them make the change they want with their powerful subconscious mind. So it's more of an experiential, especially in the first time around, really much more experiential when they see and experience hypnosis for what it is. Then they, nine times out of ten, they say, oh, my God, that's not what I thought it was going to be. And then from there, off we go.
Okay. You know, you do have a great blog on your website, and a couple of the entries discuss those five myths. But so people listening can go to your website, go to the blog, and read those. But in the meantime, can you talk a little bit about what those myths are, just so that people have an idea? Maybe we can dispel those myths right off the bat.
Absolutely. Like I said, you know, most people who don't know hypnosis and have only seen it on the stage think that hypnosis is almost kind of like Night of the Living Dead kind of thing, where you become an out-of-control zombie. And so we these five myths, they dispel. The first one is that when you're in the hypnotic state, and let me just say that hypnosis, the state of hypnosis, is a very normal and natural state. We're in and out of it all day long. You know, if you're watching a movie and you're absorbed in the movie or television show, so much so that you're not paying attention to the people around you or the noise on the street or anything like that. You're laughing, you're crying, you're aroused, you're angry. In that moment, you're in the hypnotic state. when you're absorbed in that moment. Or if you're driving your car, you pull into your driveway or your carport or along the street, and you realize you're thinking about last night's movie and not paying attention to your driving, but successfully navigated several lanes of traffic and a red light or two, in that moment, you're in the hypnotic state. So hypnosis is a natural state of absorption. So having said that, the myths that we have to dispel are this. Number one, you don't lose consciousness when you're being hypnotized. Again, stage hypnosis would have you believe that with the snap of the finger or dropping a set of keys on the floor that, you know, people just collapse. And that's not the case in clinical hypnotherapy work. You don't lose consciousness. Hypnosis has been likened to the state very similar to a daydream. So just think when you're daydreaming, of course, you know, you're certainly absorbed in whatever it is you're daydreaming about, but you're not unconscious. And hypnosis is the same thing. So the first thing is you're not unconscious. The second myth to dispel is that you're not going to lose control. People are always worried about that. Matter of fact, I tell my clients that when you enter the hypnotic state, you actually have more control over your mind and not less, because you're learning how to have the conscious and the subconscious mind working in sync. And when they work in sync and are in harmony, then you are able to have more control over your life and not less. The third myth is that people are afraid that they're going to reveal some dark, hidden, long-lost secret. Now, dark, hidden, long-lost secrets may come to your mind because as we tap into the subconscious mind, which is 93% of your mind power, things will come up to you, and they might be things that we can use in therapy to help you overcome the issues that you're dealing with. But you don't blurt them out. If you want to tell me what secrets come to mind, then you certainly can. But that's not what we're there for. And so, you know, you're not going to, you know, reveal that when I was three, I kissed my dog, or, you know, whatever it is that people are, whatever it is that people are worried about that they're going to reveal. The fourth myth is that in hypnosis, in the hypnotic state, in the therapeutic state, I'm not going to put a hypnotic suggestion into you so that at 5 p.m. tonight, when you're out on the street and all of a sudden you hear a horn honk, that you're going to start taking your clothes off, you know, or that when you're watching television and that it's time to change the show to another, then all of a sudden you're going to start drooling uncontrollably. You know, we do not do that in hypnotherapy. We don't program you to do crazy things. Again, it's a partnership, a cooperation between you and me. In so many ways, hypnosis is self-hypnosis, and my job is to be your guide. So you don't have secrets implanted within you. And then the last myth that's really helpful to understand is that we do not change in the hypnotic state any cherished moral belief that you might have. We don't change an orientation from one political party to the next, one sexuality from one form to the next. We don't touch the very deep parts of your essential core nature. We are working with the issues that you bring to the therapy session, and we use your mind to help you accomplish it. So those are the five myths. You don't lose control. You don't lose consciousness. You don't reveal secrets. You don't have secret programming that happens, and you don't change cherished moral beliefs. Once those five myths are overcome, people can relax and enjoy the work that we're doing.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because some of those myths are just so perpetuated by you know, things that we see, entertainment, you know, suggests, you know, that we're going to go ahead and plant that, you know, subversive suggestion in you to, mm-hmm. you know, to get you to do. So it would be true then that, like, for example, if someone were to want to, you know, dealing with addiction is a very common, something very common for that hypnosis is used to assist in overcoming. So with something like that, when you're dealing with that, with the if, I mean, obviously somebody wants to smoke, they're going to smoke, you know. Trying to get them off of that addiction or away from that addiction, would you would not plant into them sort of, or suggest, you know, that you know, anything to avoid smoking. So how does?
Oh no, you would, but you're doing that with their permission.
Okay, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to kind of get at, because you know, obviously, you know, with addiction treatment, so basically, it's the people when they come to you, there is a some kind of change that they want to have happen in their life, and want hypnotherapy sessions to be able to assist with that change.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, matter
okay.
of fact, well, that, matter of fact, the number, in the United States, the number one reason people come to hypnosis in the United States is to stop smoking. The number two reason that people come to hypnotherapy in the United States is to lose weight. The number three kind of spreads out. You know, people have a fear of flying or public speaking, or they want to increase their financial portfolio or be better at relationships. But number one and two are really overwhelmingly clear. People want to stop smoking or they want to lose weight. And both of those are, those issues are deeply embedded in the subconscious mind, and hypnosis is very effective with that. But also, like I said, you know, I deal with people in the office here who are coming off of ecstasy, of heroin or cocaine or meth or ecstasy. And hypnosis is a wonderful tool to help them lower the anxiety level, because what happens with addicts, of course, is when you don't have the substance that you feel like you need, your anxiety levels go up, and maybe we can talk about anxiety later. But so by helping anyone with an addiction learn how to lower the anxiety and enter into a much more calm and relaxed state, it would help them with their addictions and the process of releasing those.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, and with opioid epidemic that we have too. I mean, that's a kind of a different kind of addiction, but that would also be treatable through hypnosis.
Yes, and I'm very fortunate that I work in an office with a psychiatrist and two internal medicine doctors and some nurse practitioners, and so we really take a team approach to people who are coming off of opiates or other kinds of narcotics, because there are certainly medical things that need to be taken into mind when helping somebody detox from drugs, you know. So having the psychiatrist, the internal medicine doctors here, you know, then they bring me in as the adjunct. They bring me in to help lower the anxiety levels, to help lower the feeling of response needs and all that kind of thing. So it really is a wonderful experience here. But hypnotherapy alone can make a big difference. I'm just blessed that we have a team to be able to work with these folks with.
Yeah, it's great because, I mean, when you talk about mind, body, and spirit, I mean they all obviously interact with each other, and to be able to have subject matter experts in each, you know, really – at least you know that all of those areas are getting proper attention, and especially in recognizing the interaction between all.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your magnificent mind, discovering your magnificent mind. What was the inspiration for you to write this book? I mean, what drove Dr. David James to put this book together?
Well, it's a very easy read. It's only 100 plus pages. And there are some actual practical exercises in the back of the book to help make the kinds of change that you want. So what I did, though, is that I took all of my practice, all of my experience, all of my learning, and I said, how can I help the most people? Because not everybody can come to Beverly Hills to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do work around the world with Skype and Zoom with people, I do hypnosis sessions in Dubai and London and Paris with clients. I have one in Sacramento. But this book is kind of the compilation of what it would be like to spend two or three sessions with me in my office, discovering how to use your mind so that you can make the changes that you want in your mind. So it really is kind of on paper what it would be like to be with me for a couple of three sessions.
Okay. One of the things that I want to kind of go through a couple of the topics that in the book that kind of just stood out to me that mm-hmm. I thought would be, you know, great discussion. And first of all, one of the very first things in the book is you talk about miracles, and miracles are mm-hmm. your birthright. And I thought, now, is this the theology coming out, or is this psychotherapy coming out, or is this the officer who actually saw miracles happening? So can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about mm-hmm. the idea? Because, you know, we're in a time where, you know, where we're so focused on science and proving things, and a lot of times we kind of get away from the idea of a miracle. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Miracles were very traditionally seen as an act or a moment or an opportunity where God or an angel or a saint would intervene in the day-to-day course of human affairs and change a circumstance for the better. A physical healing, you know, a financial windfall, finding true love. You know, people have prayed for millennia to their gods, to their spirits, to the universe. And so miracles were always seen as God from out there, quote unquote, out there,
mm-hmm.
causing a change to happen here in the here and now. One of the things that we are very fortunate to know are the advances of quantum physics and understanding the correlation between energy and matter, and coming to realize that all matter, everything that's substantial from the chair upon which I sit to the phone lines across which we're speaking, are all energy vibrating at different vibrations. And so quantum physics has shown us, thanks to Einstein and then all the work that's developed out of that, is that the things that we used to think are miraculous, translocality, being able to be present in another space at the same moment that I'm present here in Beverly Hills, is a possibility. That changing deep physical challenges, change healing diseases, bringing insight where there's been nothing but confusion. All of these things that seemed miraculous to us in the past, we have a scientific understanding of how some of these things are possible now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have discovered is that the mind is so powerful that we are able to make miraculous change. The infinite intelligence within our mind can reveal everything we need to know at every moment of time and every point of space. We can receive new thoughts that bring forth new inventions, make new discoveries, write new books or plays. We can attract the ideal companion or the right buyer for the home and provide all the money you need and financial freedom that your heart desires. And all of these things in past times would have been seen as miraculous, but now we understand that the more you know how to use your mind, the miraculous becomes part of your everyday life. Also, we've come to understand that the mind, first of all, is not located in our head. That's where the brain is.
Right.
The mind is located anywhere in our body that there's a nerve cell. So that's why you stub your toe. The actual neurons fire in the brain, but you feel the pain in your toe. You don't feel the pain in your brain. So the mind is everywhere in the body. But now we also know that the mind is able to transcend even my own personal sense of myself and experience connections with other people. We used to call it telepathy or ESP, knowing what other people are thinking. Sometimes that's a blessing, sometimes not so much, but we can do that. We can be in touch with our higher self, our higher source of energy and illumination and wisdom, that which some people choose to call God. And all of this happens seemingly miraculously as we learn to use our mind more effectively.
Yeah, so, and I understand what you're saying. And so it seems that then that we, as a civilization, have shifted from viewing miracles as external influences to recognizing that it's internal, that we can become our own miracle maker, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true, although there is certainly some both and involved in this, because, you know, I have a vibrant spiritual practice and vibrant faith myself, and I am not above calling angels for help when needed. There really is a both and. But I guess the shift in this postmodern era, in this post-quantum era, is that what we've come to realize is that we are more intimately connected with the divine than we thought we were, that we're more intimately connected with the universal energy that flows through everything in and of ourselves than we ever were before. You know, there was a time when the thought was you had to go to a certain shrine like Lourdes and be blessed with certain holy waters to receive a miraculous healing. Well, why? Because it happened there, because people experienced it there. But you can have those same kinds of healings in your own home, too, as you understand the power of the mind, because you're connecting with that same life force and energy that some choose to call God or the universe or your higher self in your own living room. So that's why it's exciting, and it also saves travel costs to shrines around the world.
It does, it does. And I'm with you, too. I call on those angelic, you know, assistants, you know, quite often. Okay, you can help me now. I'm ready.
Yeah.
So let's see. One of the things then, you know, when we're talking about that connection, you know, I believe one of the purposes of your book is to recognize that power that we have within and the ability to connect to, and throughout the book you call it creative intelligence or God, but to be able to have that connection and strengthen that connection.
Absolutely. And it is, frankly, a learned practice kind of thing. The more that you build that muscle, the more you're able to use it.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Well, we're going to take just a quick break, David. I do want to invite listeners that if you would like to call in and ask David any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in, and we'll get to those right after the break. We're going to have like a 90-second break here, David. And then when we come back, you kind of just mentioned briefly during the first half about the placebo effect. And I'd really like to talk a little bit more about that because, you know, that's one of those areas where I believe in your book you call it truly is mind over matter. So I want to talk about that when we come back. Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again. Today, my very special guest is Dr. David James, and we're discussing his book, Discovering Your Magnificent Mind. Again, you can find out more about his book, as well as his services, by visiting the website, www.davidjameshypnosis.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back. David?
Woohoo!
Great. Great. I didn't lose you there. Okay, so the placebo effect. You spent some time, you know, talking about it in the book, and so can you let us know exactly, you know, what how that is a kind of a factor, or how is that part of our magnificent mind?
One of the things that we have learned in the last 100 years has been the power of the mind to heal the body. Now, as I said, as people of faith and religious practice, there's been the notion of laying on of hands for healing and prayers for healing and shrines, visits to shrines for healings, and all these things, wonderfully powerful experiences. But what we're learning now is that there is a sense in which the mind itself can heal the body. And I have several examples of this in the book. But for example, during World War II, there was a doctor named Henry Beecher. He was a surgeon, and he was treating horrendous casualties of war. And what they would do is that as the patient would come in to be prepped for surgery, they would get a shot of a narcotic like morphine. And the morphine would put them to sleep, and the doctor would be able to do the surgery to save their life. And then on the other end, you know, they would have anesthesia during the surgery. But then at the other end, they would come out, and they would be on their road to recovery. Well, as often happens, sometimes the best plans don't quite happen. And they ran out of morphine at this hospital that Dr. Beecher was serving at. And they were faced with a dilemma, because you can't just take my patient into surgery and just step them right down and start cutting them open. So he told his nurses, you give them, and this is an inspiration on his part, you give them a shot of saline solution, of water. And you say, okay, I'm giving you your morphine now, and as it's going in, you're going to start to feel a burning in your arm, and you're going to start to feel a relaxation, and then you're going to fall asleep, and we'll see you on the other side of surgery. And every patient that they did that with, that received the injection of saline solution, dropped off to sleep and had a wonderful surgery and woke up on the other end, because their mind believed that they were receiving medication to help them sleep, and so they did. And so that was really kind of a breakthrough moment in how this went on, because he went on to do studies to show, using this, what they used to call mental anesthesia, that people would respond just as well to what we would call in this conversation hypnotic suggestion as they did to the actual medicines. And then in 1978, Dr. John Levine at the University of San Francisco changed how we thought about this placebo effect. The word placebo is Latin for I will help. I will help.
Mm-hmm.
In 1978, at the University of San Francisco, Dr. Levine was doing dental surgery on people, severe dental surgery. And he said, okay, we're going to give you your nighty-night medicine now so you can relax and put you into that state so we can begin the dental work. And again, he injected saline solution, or had his nurse or his tech inject saline solution in the body. And with that, the patients were able to fall asleep, and they did the surgery. And that's not uncommon. I mean, we do all across the country. Hypnotherapists are sitting next to the dentist in the dentist's office, leading people through root canals and all kinds of things without anesthesia. But what was interesting about this particular case was that halfway through the treatment, they injected an actual medicine into the body of the patient that was designed to reverse their narcotic effect of morphine. And when they injected this medicine into the body of the patients would come awake and start screaming, ah! And they'd say, okay, I'm sorry. Here's more morphine. And they would inject more saline, and they'd go to sleep again. Well, what's interesting is that had this been only a mental state of relaxation, this medication that they injected midway through the procedure should not have worked.
Right.
Because its job, like Narcan, like they use the ambulance paramedics use, Narcan for people who are overdosed, was injected. And these people came back with a vengeance, if you would. And they then injected them with quote-unquote morphine, in other words, saline solution, and they relaxed again. And they didn't tell the patient halfway through the operation, okay, we're going to give you something to bring you out. It just did. So that was the opening of a new level of discovery, the interaction between mind and body in the medical world. And studies have gone on and on and on. Even in my own practice, I have a client who has ALS. It's Lou Gehrig's disease.
Right.
My client came to me in a wheelchair, couldn't stand unassisted, couldn't walk, came to me for depression. Because as you can imagine, when somebody is severely ill like this, you get very depressed very easily. And hypnosis is wonderful, not only with anxiety, but also with depression. So she came to me to work with her depression. And I said to her, you can absolutely have for me anything you want, including relieving your depression. It is my privilege to do that with you. I said, but, you know, would you be at all interested in experimenting with me a little bit and playing with me a little bit? And she said, what do you mean? And I said, would you like to see if we can work with your symptoms a little bit and bring you some relief? And, you know, maybe she was one in a million, but she said, absolutely. So after working with her for some time now, she no longer needs a wheelchair. She's using a walker. And our goal is to get her off of the walker and onto a cane. We are reversing the symptoms of her Lou Gehrig's disease only with the power of her mind. So this whole notion of placebo effect, you know, we often hear, you know, placebo, the sugar pill kind of thing.
Right.
That if the doctor gives you a pill that you think is medicine, that your body responds in like ways, and that's true. But we're also learning through the work of epigenetics, that is switching gene expression from off to on and on to off of cancer cells. We're learning the power of the mind to heal the body. And so the short little chapter, second chapter of my book on the placebo effect has case studies like this and talks about how the mind can heal the body.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I find it amazing, you know, when I first learned about the placebo effect, just to even grasp the idea that, you know, just the mind alone has that power. You know, I mean, to be able to heal. You know, and one of the things with the placebo effect, if someone, first of all, does it work on everyone? You know, because I would think that, you know, if we were to be able to, like your with your ALS patient, you know, if we were able to use this methodology on all types of disease, you know, then it seems that we would be on the road to eradicating fixing a lot of things that are wrong with our healthcare, with everything. So does this work? Does this work with everyone? I mean, because sometimes, you know, I just wonder if there is a point when a disease is just so advanced that, you know, working with the power of the mind, I mean, just really wouldn't have an effect.
Well, let me give you a little story in this regard. Mr. Wright was a patient at the UCLA Medical Center, and he had he was getting no relief from any treatment, and he developed large tumors in his neck, groin, and armpits. His oncologist had given up hope that he hoped that he'd ever recover. But ever the optimist, he thought that someday he would find something that would bring him back to health. Well, this was 25, 30 years ago, and he heard of an experimental drug called crebiocin and demanded that the doctor give him some. The doctor found it, gave him an injection, and the next day they noticed that his tumors were half their original size. And within 10 days of this miracle cure, they were gone because the crebiocin had shrunk the tumors to nothing. And he was sent home to live a normal, happy life. But then disaster struck, and I tell this story in the book. 2 months after he'd been sent home, he read an article in the LA Times and the article said that the crebiocin, this medicine, was an absolute failure, that it had not passed any medical test. And within a matter of number of days, the tumors were back in Mr. Wright, in his neck, in his groins, in his armpits. He went back to his oncologist. The doctor, kind of playing a hunch, said, oh, that was just a bad batch. We have a stronger, more pure version. Let's get you going with that again. And so they gave him another series of injections, this time not of any medication, but of saline. And sure enough, these life-threatening tumors disappeared. But then he read in the newspaper, this man should have stayed away from the newspaper. But then he read in the newspaper that the FDA had determined that this crebiocin was nothing more than essential amino acids and oil and was a fraud, and they were prosecuting the makers of the drug for fraud. And within 3 days, Mr. Wright's tumors were back, and on the fourth day, he was dead. So you tell me. You know, this man's doctor had given him up for dead. He's given an injection of a quote-unquote miracle drug, cures him. He goes home. He reads an article that says that the medicine was no good. These tumors, I mean, this is not just not feeling well. These are measurable tumors. Come back. The doctor says, oh, we've got more powerful version of the same stuff. They give him a saline injection. These tumors disappear again. He reads sometime later that this is all a fraud and a mess. He's back, and 3 days later, he's dead from this cancer. So, you know, you tell me, how far gone? Not everyone's going to have the same response to any treatment, even medicine. Not everybody gets the same response. So it would be naive and a little bit malpractice to say that everybody that comes in my office is going to be 100% better. But everybody, by learning to use the power of their mind, can bring great improvement to their life.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that's a great, you know, example of kind of what I was getting at. And now, when we're talking about the power of the mind. One of the things that I wonder, I mean, you talked a little bit about, I think it was in the beginning, something about 93% of the activity is subconscious. Was that the percentage? When we're talking about the power of the mind, does if so much of that of our life, is determined or is led in a way by that subconscious mind, is that where the power lies, really? I mean, because it seems like that's a huge part of the picture.
Yeah, the conscious mind, the 7% of the conscious mind, is our ability to have logic, reasoning, decision-making, willpower, and analysis. Now, by and large, that's all we've been trained in our schools to operate out of: logic, reasoning, decision-making, willpower, and analytical abilities. But the subconscious mind, which is the 93% mind, is where our habits, our emotions, our bodily functions, our life scripts, in other words, our deepest understandings about, quote-unquote, what life means for us. For example, I'm almost 62. I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, at the height of the Cold War. And so if I met a Russian man my age who had grown up in the Soviet Union in exactly the same time, our outlooks on life would be very different. And what is a value I have and is important to me might not be a value that he would have and be important to him. Matter of fact, he may hate American. You know, I mean, who knows? But the point is that it's the subconscious mind where all of these prejudices and all these beliefs are found, and our life scripts and our habits and our responses to stimulation and our love and our prayers. I mean, it all comes out of the subconscious mind. And so the more that we're able to use our subconscious mind in coordination with our conscious mind, so that we have our mind running on the two tracks of the train tracks they were meant to run on, that we're going to be much healthier and much happier.
Yeah. So one of the things you mentioned as far as the five myths was that, you know, you don't basically change basic beliefs. Now, is this a case where, again, it's really only because of a client's desire to change those beliefs that you would delve into that subconscious?
Nothing.
Okay, because it just seems that you know, those limiting, you know, destructive, non-productive, you know, beliefs that we have that are kind of really the life scripts that you mentioned. It seems like a lot of those can be the basis of some of the challenges that we experience in adult life.
Right. And so as a result of that, I call it personal archaeology. When we go in to change a belief, you know, we may need to chip away at other supportive beliefs. For example, let's say somebody wants to stop smoking. Now, I know that in the United States of America, the average person who has smoked all their life started when they were 13 or 14. And very likely the first time they smoked, they had they had an ally in their rebellion. In other words, it was an older brother or sister or another friend. And somehow they got the message from this ally, if you would, in rebellion, that if you smoke with me after school, around the corner, out in the backyard, you know, we're tight. We've got a connection to you. Well, so there's one association to smoking that's going to have to be undone, that smoking brings your friends, because you can find plenty of friends without smoking. Another association that's very common, especially in people of my generation, is, you know, in my day and age, when we went to the movies, you know, people smoked in the movies. All the cool people smoked. James Dean had the cigarette hanging out of his mouth at the end of the, even though even back then they didn't show lots of actual sex, when people were in bed after sex, you know, they would kind of cut into that point. They're smoking cigarettes, you know, having a nice drag. And so to people of a certain generation, smoking is seen as sexy. So there's another thing, another belief structure that you have to undo. You know, another one is that it'll make me cool, or, you know, and then of course there is the physiological nature of the nicotine, which only lasts for 3 days. I mean, from the day you've had your last cigarette, 3 days later, the nicotine's out of your body. It's such a short half-life. But we have to, you know, convince the client, you know, or the client has to become convinced that smoking A is not cool. Rather, you smell like an ashtray. That smoking is not cost-effective. You know, in California now, cigarettes start at $12 a pack. You know, we always joke about the fact that what we're going to do as we stop smoking is put that money aside so at the end of the year we can go to Cancun. So we call our cigarette money our Cancun money. And so on and on and on and on and on it goes. So when you are learning to, when you're working with a client to change a belief pattern, you very often have all these ancillary, secondary supporting belief patterns in the subconscious mind they have to take care of first before the final one can kind of collapse under its own weight.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it seems that, you know, there's, I mean, it's just so interwoven, you know what I mean? I mean, between the subconscious and the conscious mind, the different associations, you know, and it's really a relearning kind of some of our basic beliefs, you know, really kind of just shifting, basically becoming a new person with new thoughts.
Well, and it is. And Dr. Joseph Murphy was a science of mind minister here in Los Angeles in the 60s, and he used to preach every Sunday to a packed out crowds on the power of the positive mind. And he talked a lot about the fact that if you used your mind correctly, that the conscious mind becomes the conductor and the subconscious mind is the orchestra playing the symphony. Or, you know, the conscious mind is the captain of the ship and the subconscious mind is the engine room and the propulsion faculty. So if you learn to use all of your mind, you do become that new person.
Yep. Wow. That's something. And there was also one statement in your book too. There was, you had a reference to a Dr. Candace Pert, the idea that our physical body is an expression of our subconscious mind. When I looked at that,
exactly.
I thought, subconscious mind, what are you doing? I'm not supposed to be this weight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
she was not interested in hypnosis at all. She was a clinical researcher, and showed through clinical tests that mental emotions had direct one-to-one correlations on the physical body. So that's how she would say that the physical body is the subconscious mind made manifest, because there was indisputable clinical evidence that how you think affects your body and how you are in this world.
Yeah, that's amazing. But, David, we're down toward the end of the show. This hour has just flown by. Is there any topic or any points that you may want to make about the Magnificent Mind, or just anything in general that maybe I didn't cover that you think that the listeners, that you really want to say to the listeners?
Well, I think it's important to remember that we are, as human beings, really a whole piece. We're not just a mind or just a body or just a spirit. That we are really a combination of all of them. And nowhere is this more expressed than in our nervous system. You know, we have the sympathetic nervous system that when we feel like we're under assault or stressed out, activates the sympathetic nervous system. And that is what we used to call the fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, you know, blood pools in your extremities so you can fight or flight. Your pupils constrict so you're able to see just what danger is in front of you. Your heart begins to beat differently. Your soft tissues change. And so the problem is that so many of us are walking around in this stressful day and age in fight or flight all the time. You know, it's supposed to be either on or off. But John Bradshaw back in the 80s said that what's happened is that stress has become like a pilot light that's, you know, on our hot water heater that constantly runs. So as we learn to relax, as we learn to step into our magnificent mind, then our body automatically switches us into the parasympathetic nervous system, where we're able to be creative and enjoy life. It's called the rest and feed response versus the fight or flight. Even those two images, fight or flight versus rest and feed. So if your listeners take away one thing from this interview, besides buy my book and learn more, how's that for hypnotic suggestion? That if
real subliminal there.
Take away, that's right. Yeah, not too right. Is that the more we learn to relax, the more we learn to trust the energy of the universe, the guidance of our higher self, our universal mind, some call it God, the more we're able to relax and experience a sense of well-being practically in our bodies, the better for us. Because like I said, that enhances creativity. It allows us to make decisions with a clearer perspective than just fight or flight, than it is kind of hanging on by the skin of our teeth. So I would encourage the practice of relaxation for everybody every day.
Yeah, you know, that is so important, because, I mean, I come across people every day who have that pilot light going, you know, and they're just in that constant state of stress or agitation. And you know, you can just see the toll that it takes on the physical body. And, you know, it's a shame, because we do, like you say, we do have that ability to turn that pilot light off for a little bit.
Well, yes, and you know, further, when the pilot light's on, when you are in the fight or flight, of course, your body is pumping norepinephrine and epinephrine and adrenaline through your body. It's like opening up your head and pouring the entire day's worth of coffee from Starbucks store into you alone. You know, and that just takes its toll on your body. You do it over and over and over again, and that's constantly pumping through you. Whereas if you learn to relax, then other more life-affirming, life-enhancing chemicals start naturally coming through your body. So, yeah, relaxation is so important.
It is. Well, David, thank you for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you about your magnificent mind, our magnificent minds, and sharing your information with the listeners. It's really been a delight.
Well, I'm grateful for the opportunity. Like I said, I can be reached on my website, and I can have sessions with your listeners by Skype. And, of course, the book is available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. But if you go to my website, it's right there on the front page. You can click it as to the show page that you have up today also. So thank you very much for all of this.
Great. You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. David James. We've been discussing his book, Discovering Your Magnificent Mind. And like he said, you can find out more by visiting his website, www.davidjameshypnosis.com. And again, that there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. And I'd also recommend that you go ahead and read some of the blogs that he has. They're very informative. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.